Oh, thank you, Emily, for that beautiful song and beautiful message as well. I was thinking, too, as we were singing that last congregational song, Molding a Masterpiece, I'm so thankful that we have mothers that actually believe in us. You know, that they actually see some potential there. And that's why they keep on doing what they do. And all the world may think that you're a loser, but if you got your mom in your corner, you don't need too much else, right? And I'm thankful for my mother, and I'm thankful for my wife, who is a wonderful mother to my children. And I'm just thankful that God, knowing exactly what we needed, created the position of mother for us. And this morning, I want us to take our Bibles and turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Of course, I was, just the other day, I was talking about the Ten Commandments with a young couple. And I was explaining that the Ten Commandments are really more than just a list of do's and don'ts. You know, don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. It's more than just a set of rules. It's really an explanation of the character of our God. So, for instance, when it says, thou shalt not commit adultery, well, that teaches us that God is a faithful God. God is always faithful in His relationships, in His commitments. When it says, don't bear false witness, don't lie, that's because God is a God of truth. And so, for us to be like God, we shouldn't be lying. We shouldn't be committing adultery. We shouldn't be stealing, etc., etc. Well, there is one of the Ten Commandments, the fifth one, that Paul actually highlights here in chapter 6. If we are going to be filled with the Spirit, as it says in Ephesians 5:18, then, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. And what was that promise? That it would be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And so here is a commandment with a promise. If you want things to go well in life, listen to your mother. And that is certainly very true, right? I've thought about this, though. What does this look like for somebody to honor their mother? Now, it's always apparent when I'm talking with somebody and trying to show them that we're all sinners, we deserve to go to hell, and that sort of thing, I always take them to the Ten Commandments. And this is one of the ones that I'll use that gets them every time, right? I'll say something like this. Has there ever been a time in your life when you disobeyed your mother? And right there, okay, guilty, you know. I mean, you don't have to go any further than that. You can, you know, have you ever told a lie? Well, of course, yes. But boy, I get them every time on honor your father and your mother. And it's not just obedience, it's actually showing respect. And, you know, they can think back to those teenage years when maybe they obeyed their mother, but they did it kind of stomping their foot or rolling their eye or getting upset or, oh, boy, you blew it right there too. So whether you're a little kid not doing it or you're an older kid and you're doing it, but you have a rotten attitude about it, ah, man, you've broken that law. So what would it look like if somebody actually honored their mother the way they're supposed to? Well, you know, we have an example of that. And I invite you now to turn to Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2. And really, the theme of this message this morning is honor your mother. Honor your mother. What does that look like? Well, first of all, honor includes obedience. Honor includes obedience. And we're going to start in Luke chapter 2, verse 41. Now his, referring to Jesus's, now Jesus's parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. Let me pause here for a moment. I believe that one of the reasons why God the Father would entrust Joseph and Mary with this child is for this reason. Verse 41. Boy, they loved God. Now, it was required for adult Jewish males 3 times a year to make the trek down to Jerusalem. It was not required for the mother. In fact, if the wife went, that was especially an act of piety. That meant that she really did love the Lord. She didn't have to do it, but she chose to do it. And so it was that Joseph and Mary, as was their custom, went down to Jerusalem. Now, let's think about this. This was an 80-mile journey by foot. This would take at least 4 days just to get there if you walked 20 miles a day. Mothers, imagine doing that with small children. I was thinking about that today. That'd be like, for instance, driving to California. Imagine piling your 4 or 5 kids into the minivan and driving 4 days to California. Oh, you have to do 800 miles a day. And you have to sleep in the van. That would be fun, wouldn't it? After about 3 hours, hey, are we there yet? Mom, he's touching me. You know how that goes, right? So imagine every year doing this. 4 days travel down, 4 days travel back, 20 miles a day by foot with children. Having to carry all your provisions with you. There's no McDonald's along the way. And so it is that this couple, they loved the Lord so much, they were willing to inconvenience themselves. They were willing to spend time, no matter what the cost was, spend time in God's house, learning, worshiping together. And I believe it's just as important today for moms and dads to see the importance of coming together and worshiping in God's house, learning, hearing the Word of God proclaimed, living it out in their lives. I just challenge you, perhaps you haven't thought much about this before, but I challenge you to consider even a Sunday night service. That's like real devotion, right? Hey, what about Wednesday night, that time of prayer? And so it was that here was a young couple that they just determined that they loved God, and that's a good thing because they had the Messiah that they were training in their house. And you say to yourself, maybe, I don't have the Messiah in my house, that's for sure. But you know what? Who knows what that little one may do one day? And God gave you that child for unique opportunities. That child may change the world for Christ. And you have by the way, as we get older, I realize how little time you actually have with your children. Right? It seems like just yesterday they were born, and the next thing you know, you're walking down the aisle seeing them get married. And they move away. You have a brief amount of time. Well, Joseph and Mary, they made it their habit to make this trek down to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. They travel 4 days down, they celebrate for about 7 days, and then travel 4 days back. Verse 42, and when he, that is Jesus, was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And they had fulfilled the days, they'd been there the whole week for the whole Feast of Unleavened Bread after the Passover. As they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. But they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey. And they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances. When they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. I think we've all had this. If you have multiple children in your family, you've had this kind of experience. Especially if you have multiple vehicles. This happened in my family. There are five boys, and I'm the oldest of five boys. And so, invariably, you know, we're just kind of scattered throughout the building, right? Some of us are playing in the gym with our friends. Some of us are talking in the back of the auditorium. And mom and dad, you know, it takes a while to corral everybody. And just as you get them all corralled, then somebody else wants to talk to the dad, you know. And so it's just, so sometimes my mom would drive separately because she knew dad would be at church for a long time talking. And she'd have to get home and get the food ready. And so, you know, she'd take some of the kids maybe. But then the dad doesn't know, like, which kids were taken, which kids were not. We basically, we had a certain dropping off place. We had to stand, and we stand against the brick wall near the door in a stair step fashion all the way down to the youngest, standing there waiting for mom or dad or both to come. But occasionally, they would get signals crossed, and we, you know, get a phone call at home. Mr. Rambler, are you going to be picking up Steve? Oh, I forgot Steve. You know, and it happens sometimes. And this is what happened here. Now, how old is Jesus? He's 12. 12. So it's that kind of that age where do you play with the little kids or do you want to be more with the grown-ups? And so it is that, is he going to be with his mom and the little kids or with the dad and the bigger grown-up people, you know, type of thing? And so apparently Mary just thinks Jesus is with Joseph, his dad. Joseph just thinks he's with Mary, the kids, playing. And they're not concerned about it. It's kind of like a village, I'm imagining. It's like a village migration. They come down for the feast. They go back together. So it was a great time of fellowshipping, and the wives can walk together along the way and chat and talk, and the men can talk about their things and so forth. And so, and the children just went along, and they had a great time together, playing, messing around, throwing rocks probably, you know, lots of rocks over there. And so as they're walking along, Mary's not concerned. She's probably with Joseph. Joseph's not concerned. He's probably with Mary. Because I believe that Jesus was always where he was supposed to be. Can you imagine having a child that was always where they were supposed to be? But Jesus was that way. He was always where he was supposed to be. So they weren't worried. And they come, they've just walked 20 miles, they've gone a whole day's journey. And Mary says, well, how did Jesus do today? What, you know, Jesus, I thought he was with you. With me? No, he wasn't with me. I thought he was with you. And all of a sudden, the sinking realization that Jesus was not with them. Now they've got to walk 20 miles back by themselves. So gone is the camaraderie of the neighbors and the friend. Now you're just by yourself. And you have 20 miles in a day to think about what might have happened to Jesus. And I'm sure the level of anxiety is rising in Mary's heart, as any mother's heart would be. And they finally make it back at dark to Jerusalem. Now, remember, Jerusalem is just flooded with people this time of year. So it's bustling. It's crowded. There's people everywhere. It's like looking for a needle in a... You're looking for a 12-year-old boy in the midst of a bustling city. And I can only imagine now the level of anxiety growing even higher in Mary's heart. And so the next day, they start searching, and they're looking all... And 3 days go by, and finally, on this third day, probably towards the end of the day, they make their way to the temple. Maybe there's some... Maybe the teaching session is just kind of breaking up, and they spot Jesus all the way down front, kind of maybe in a semicircle with the teachers of the land, the great scholars and doctors, Jewish doctors there, and Jesus kind of the center of attention as he's engaging, dialoguing with these grand teachers about the scriptures. You know how it is, parents, when you are scared to death that something might have happened to your child, and when you find them, and they're fine, in fact, they're having a good time playing, you have such conflicting emotions, right? You're like so happy, you want to hug them,
you're so mad you want to squeeze their necks, you know, and just like, oh, what are you doing?
Well, that's kind of what happened, because notice here, verse 45, and it's interesting, it says they were seeking him. So this is, they're ongoing, they're frenzied, this is an ongoing activity, and it came to pass that after the 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him, this is a 12-year-old boy these adults are listening to, were astonished at his understanding and answers. And I think it's very interesting, that word astounded, astonished. Luke frequently uses that term to describe the wonder that emerged from an action that was associated with God's presence. So like when Jesus would do and raise somebody from the dead, people were astonished. Hey, God is doing something here. God is here in our midst. It's the word used here of a 12-year-old boy. As he is engaging these great doctors in the law, the people are astonished. They knew God was in their midst. And in fact, Jesus was Emmanuel, right? God with us. Notice how Mary responds, as any mother would. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? I'm sure she's thinking, I've just walked 40 miles for nothing. 2 days of walking, plus a day in the city looking for you. And it says, and behold, thy father and I have sought thee. We've been continually looking for you, sorrowing. So this, all this, she is highly irritated at this point. Very upset with Jesus at this point. But you know what? Honor includes obedience, even when our parents are not perfect. They're irritated. Jesus had made them look so bad. Oh, they lost one of their kids. Well, they're, you know, what does that say about their parenting skills, you know? I'm sure they're thinking about this, like, oh, I'm a bad parent. Oh, something probably happened. And they're irritated. They're upset, obviously, because they love their child. But they're also thinking about themselves a little bit here, you know? What this is going to make me look like, perhaps, as well as being concerned and anxious. And by the way, if this is the promised child, the Messiah, the Savior of the world, he's not going to be mugged and killed in the streets of Jerusalem, right? This is actually lack of faith on Mary's part. Now, by the way, we can't judge her too harshly, because I think all of us would probably have responded the same way. If you lost your 12-year-old son like this, probably respond the way. But it just shows us, you know, Mary's not perfect. She's a mom with these natural inclinations, and she's a human being with these natural inclinations. She's irritated. She's upset. A little bit of unbelief here. And what does Jesus do? Notice it says in verse 49, and Jesus said unto them, how is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business? Jesus, didn't you know I'd be right here? Doing exactly what my Heavenly Father wanted me to do. Hey, why are you so upset, Mom? Now we can understand that, right? Mom, why are you so upset? I've been looking for you for 3 days. I walked 40 miles. I didn't know where you were. There's a lot of strangers. A lot of bad things happen around here. There are Roman soldiers all over the place. Why are you so upset, Mom? I'm exactly where I ought to be. And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them. By the way, Jesus honored his mom even when they misunderstood him. So his parents misunderstood him. And they're not perfect. He went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he was subject unto them. In other words, he put himself under their authority. He honored his parents. Even though they're not perfect, even though they misunderstood him, I believe that this was a real seminal point in the understanding of Jesus. I believe it was at this point as a 12-year-old boy that he knew who he was and why he was there. And he knew he had to get this instruction. He was getting this training. He was getting the teaching here. It was all coming to fruition. And in fact, it's interesting. It says in verse 49, "Wished ye not that I must be about my Father's business, not our Father's?" He understood that there was a unique difference here. As a 12-year-old boy, it all came to fruition. And I can't imagine what it would have been like that day to discuss biblical truths, first of all, with a perfect human being. Can you imagine how much your brain could process if it had no sin? If it had no consequences of sin, no sin scars, you could use all of your brain perhaps, as Adam did initially in the garden there. Now you think about it. Adam could name every single animal and not forget its name. Right? Lion. You know, we do it. We get halfway through like, wait, what did I call that thing again? Like, oh, wait, somebody have a piece of paper here? You know, we'd be like, Adam, boy, can you imagine every single animal naming it and remembering it? I can't imagine the kind of mind that Jesus would have had that day. And then the purity of soul, all of that coming together. No wonder people sensed the presence of God that day. If anybody had a right to say, "Mom, I am your creator. Go. I have work to do." You know, it's something like, he had that right. But what does it say? It says that he went with them back to Nazareth, a dirty, dusty village out in the middle of nowhere. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? You know, it was the same. And he honored his mother. He created Mary and Joseph, and yet he submitted himself to his mother. Honor your mother. This honor includes obedience, even when your parents aren't perfect, even when they misunderstand you. We're still supposed to honor our mother. Take your Bibles and turn to John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Let's look at another incident in the life of Jesus. John chapter 2. And verse 1. "In the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee. And the mother of Jesus was there." So Mary is there. By the way, Joseph is now gone off the scene. I believe Joseph may have died when Jesus was in his teen years, which kind of is interesting if you think about Jesus being the oldest son. When his father died, he would have had to take over the business, the family business, which was carpentry. That's why he sometimes was called the carpenter's son. Sometimes he's actually just called the carpenter. So perhaps Jesus grew up in a single-parent home, helping his mom raise the younger kids, earning money, making provision. And verse 2, "And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, They have no wine." Now, we don't quite understand this in our culture today, but often in a wedding, it would go on, the celebration would go on for a week. And the groom's family was responsible to provide, make provisions for all of the guests for a week. In fact, it was the height of incompetence. It was very demeaning. In fact, you could even be sued by the bride's family if you ran out. "Hey, we came. We expected to be fed. We expected, wine throughout the week and you've run out, you can be sued for that. It was a big disgrace to any family to run out. And I don't know what happened. It doesn't really tell us, but apparently there was more people that showed up than was anticipated. And the groom's family is now faced with this terrible, disgraceful thing that they have run out of wine. And I think it's interesting that the first thing Mary does, and apparently Mary is probably like the wedding coordinator type of thing. You know, she's in charge of the making sure the food and the drink and everything, and they're running out. And she goes right to Jesus. Now, by the way, before this, how many miracles had Jesus done? Zero. Because the Bible tells us this was the first miracle that Jesus did. So Mary's not coming to Jesus saying, hey, can you do a miracle and just create some more wine? No. Apparently, Jesus was a very good problem solver. Oh, we don't know what to do. Well, go ask Jesus. He'll know what to do. That must have been the typically what would happen. And so Mary comes to Jesus and says, they have no wine. And Jesus says unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. By the way, this sounds kind of rude, doesn't it? Woman, what have I to do with you? Like, oh, you got a problem now? Well, what, you come to me now? That's not what Jesus is communicating here. And by the way, you know that's not what he's communicating, because notice what in verse 5, his mother said unto the servants, whatsoever he says to you, do it. So however Jesus communicated what he just said, it's not a rude, like, get out of here. What are you asking me for this? It's not that at all. In fact, she knows, he's going to do something. Let me put it this way. It'd be something like, dear woman, why do you involve me in this concern? See, Jesus now was embarking upon his grand mission, that of redeeming mankind from sin. Running out of wine at a wedding? Not that important in the grand scheme of human history, right? In essence, Jesus is saying, you know, I have great things to do here, Mother. I'm not your little boy anymore. But he must have said it in such a way that Mary knew something was going to happen. Jesus would take care of it. Jesus, even though this was really not a part of the grand scheme of human redemption, Jesus respected her request. You know, honor involves not only obedience, but deference, respect. Jesus respected her request. And she kind of figures that out. And she tells the servants, hey, Jesus is about to do something. So whatever he tells you, even though if it seems kind of weird, just do it. And it says here, and there were set there six water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing two or three firkins apiece. So that could have been about 150 gallons apiece. And Jesus said unto the servants, fill the water pots with water. Well, that's not weird, because typically you'd have these pots sitting there ready for purification. Pour some water on the hands or on the feet or maybe on a vessel, you know, to kind of wash things. So you have to have water there to do that, to purify the guests for this wonderful ceremony. And they filled these pots, each of them, to the brim. They weren't stingy on this. And he said unto them, and here's where it gets a little odd, draw out now and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. In other words, okay, the governor of the feast, he always has to taste the next batch of wine before he then serves it, make sure that it passes muster. And he's asking them to take water and take it to the governor to see how he likes the wine. But Mary said, whatever he says, do you do it? This would have been an act of faith on their part. But they were just doing what they were told. And when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was. But the servants which drew the water knew. The governor of the feast called the bridegroom. He said unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth his best wine. And as the course of the week goes on, when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But why have you kept the best wine until now? And this was the beginning of the miracles that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. But the point I want to make here is that Jesus not only honored the request of his mother, even though really he didn't need to do that. In fact, it really wasn't, you know, a part of the grand scheme. Jesus made it a part of the grand scheme. He added it to his busy schedule. He included that. He honored her request, and he even exceeded her request. He did even more, really, than what she had expected. It wasn't just mediocre quality wine. It was the best. Now, this is my personal speculation here, okay? Can't justify this necessarily from the text, but the fact that they had been there all week, the fact that they had well drunk, I believe that what Jesus did here was that he created wine as though it were freshly squeezed from the grape, before it had even fermented. You never got that kind of wine. I mean, the minute you stomp on the grapes and it sits there for a minute, it starts to ferment. Here, this would have been like, and we can't even fully understand it, this is like freshly squeezed grape juice. It's kind of like the difference between when you get the stuff out of the carton, pour your orange juice, as opposed to going somewhere where they have orange orchards all around, and they have this big, I've had one of these before, where they have this big hopper, and they pour all the oranges on top of it, into it, and you put your glass under, and the oranges come down, and they get squeezed, and it goes right into your cup. Oh, man. That orange juice is unbelievable. Freshly squeezed orange juice. Well, this is like freshly squeezed grape juice, I believe. It was just, it blew the socks off of anything that had been served. I'm like, why did you wait till the end? Because Jesus doesn't do anything halfway. This is the wonderful thing about service to our God. God's promises of provision, God's rewards for service, it just gets better and better and better and better. Have you ever noticed that with the world's promises, it just, they promise you this great thing, and you're like all excited and pumped up, and then, it's not, like the pictures of the burger on the signs? Never quite looks like that, does it? Why is that? You know, the picture of the guy on the boat in the middle of the lake with the sun, and the fish are biting like left and right, and he's got a can of beer. Like drinking beer makes all of this happen, you know? It never quite meets the expectations. But in God's line of service, in God's economy, the expectations pale in comparison to the reality. That's just the way our God is. Jesus, in dealing with his mother, honored her requests and even exceeded those requests. You see, honor includes not only obedience, but deference. Honor also includes prioritization. I'm going to just read very quickly this passage from Mark chapter 3, verses 31 to 35, and then make some comments. There came then his brethren and his mother, and standing without, sent unto him, calling him. And the multitude sat about him, and they said unto him, behold, thy mother and thy brethren without seek for thee. And he answered them, saying, who is my mother or my brethren? And he looked round about on them which sat about him, and said, behold, my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and my mother. And at first glance, they're like, oh, that's kind of rude. His mom and his brothers are outside. By the way, it's been very busy ministry. The house is crowded where they are, and nobody can get in to talk to Jesus. And the mother and brothers are out there, and the people say, "Hey, your mom and your brothers are out there. They want to talk to you." Oh, wait. First of all, I think there's a great truth that Jesus is communicating here. Mothers have access to their children, right? Doesn't matter if you're the president of the United States. If mom calls, you take the call, right? They have access. There's a relationship there. But, you know, all of us have that kind of relationship with Jesus. You know how some people will say, well, we need to pray to Mary because Mary is Jesus' mother, and Jesus will certainly listen to his mother. The Catholics believe that, right? But Jesus is saying here, hey, look, every one of us who are his children, we have the same access to him as Mary does. This is wonderful. But here's another truth about honor. Honor includes prioritization. Honor includes prioritization. Now, let me back up here a moment, too. The reason why Mary and his brothers often were trying to get to Jesus is they were so concerned for him. I'm sure Mary probably said this. She said it once. She probably said it 100 times. Jesus, you're just doing too much. You're going to wear yourself out. You need to take some time for yourself. Yeah, I'm sure she probably did that. In fact, I was thinking about this morning. I was going around the house with these little plastic clips that you put in your electrical socket so that my granddaughter, who is one, doesn't stick her fingers in the electrical socket. We're constantly, no, don't touch. And so she walks from that to the next electrical socket, you know, and, well, I can't touch that one, but I can touch this one. And, no, don't touch. And you're like, you know what? We better just put those little plugs in so that she can't stick her fingers in there. Well, sometimes moms do that to their children when they're 35 years old, right? No, don't take that job. That's dangerous. Don't go on that trip. Yep. Mom, I'm 42 years old, okay? I really think God wants me to do this. Oh, it's a mom's job, I guess, to worry about their children, right? And I'm sure this was part of the thinking here of Mary, backed up by the brothers, you know, to talk to Jesus. Jesus, you need to slow down. You're going to wear yourself out, and you can't save the world. Well, actually, yes, he actually can save the world. But, you know, she's just doing a mother here, the mother thing. Well, Jesus very clearly in other places teaches. Here's a challenge. If any man come to me and hate not his mother, father, and mother, and wife, and children, and brethren, and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Matthew chapter 10, verses 37 to 39. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. And he that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. It was that passage, by the way, that God used to lead me from Chicago to Maryland to be the pastor of this church, to leave mother and father behind. But on the flip side, Jesus also gives a warning. We're talking about prioritization here. Okay, what's most important and so forth. There's a warning as well, not only a challenge, but a warning in Matthew chapter 15, verses 4 through 6. For God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father or his mother, he shall be free. Thus have ye made commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. The idea here of cursing means to speak ill of your parents. What has happened in this passage is that there were Jewish people that would say, oh, mom and dad, you need this? Well, I'm sorry. I dedicated it to God. And so I cannot give it to you, mom and dad.
It belongs to God. Now, they could use it for themselves. It'd be kind of like, let's say you have a home, build a big addition on it. Your parents are up in years. They need somewhere to stay. Maybe they've just lost their house. There's nowhere for them to go. And they say, son, I would like to live in your addition. You say, I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. I've dedicated that to house missionaries who come through and need housing. So, Mom and Dad, you're going to have to live on the streets. And we kind of laugh at it. But people were doing that. By the way, people still do that today. They stick them in a nursing home. Now, that, by the way, I'm not saying that a nursing home is necessarily wrong. Sometimes there's a need for those, and sometimes they reach a point where they need 24-hour care, and you just can't. I'm not talking about, but I'm talking about when you're trying to get rid of them. You just don't want to deal with it. You're thinking ill or speaking ill of them. What Jesus is doing is he's showing us a balance here, prioritization. Love God more than family, but love family more than self. Love God more than family, but love family more than self. And Jesus showed this throughout his life. True honoring of a parent, of a mother, involves prioritization. To put your mom above God, that's not good for God or you. It's not good for your mom or you. Put God first. By the way, if you put God first, your mom will receive the honor she is due. Love God more than family, and love family more than self. And finally, honor includes compassion. Let's end with this passage. Turn to John chapter 19. Very quickly, John chapter 19 and verse 25. John 19, verse 25. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, that was John, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her unto his own home. Honor includes compassion. Honor includes compassion. Just think about what was going on in Jesus' life at this moment. He's just been nailed to a cross, let alone all the physical suffering that led up to this. The scourging, the beatings, the spitting, the crown of thorns, all of that, the walk being paraded through the streets, all of the emotional and physical abuse that he had just suffered. He's just now been nailed to a cross. That cross has been lifted and thrown into place. The body has been jarred. He's fighting for his physical life, but far worse, my sins and your sins were being placed on Jesus' shoulders at that moment. And Jesus is concerned about what's going to happen to his mother? Who's going to take care of her? Yes. In the midst of perhaps the darkest hour of humanity's existence, tremendous trial and stresses, Jesus is thinking about, how's his mom going to make it through the next couple of years? Who's going to take care of mom? How's she going to survive? How's she going to live? And he turns to John. John, I'm putting my mom into your care. And church history tells us, by the way, John took very good care of Mary all the rest of her days. True compassion trumps personal problems and meets others' needs. It would not be until Jesus had wrapped up all the loose ends, like caring for his mother, that he was now ready to fulfill his grand plan. It would not be finished until Mary had been cared for. He would go on to say, It is finished, and into thy hands I commend my spirit, but not until his mom
was taken care of, both physically and spiritually. You know, we need to build relationships with others, with our mothers, with others as well, in order to meet their needs. You can't meet somebody's needs until you get to know them. You need to call your mom today. She's not here. Talk with her. Say thank you. I close by reading this thoughtful, these thoughts by a man by the name of Kirk Rule. He said, "When I was a child, I heard the Ten Commandments as hard rules that were impossible to fully understand, let alone fulfill. I concluded rightly or wrongly that they were for grown-ups, and I told myself that I'd worry about them later. Yet there was that bit in the middle, honor your father and your mother, that somehow stood out. My interpretation at 9 years old was, do what they tell you. This instruction was clear and practical, but to my current sensibilities, it feels pretty skimpy, more like humble compliance. I'm learning a new kind of honoring now. My mom lives with Alzheimer's and is more dependent. I am distant geographically, so I hired a team of Spokane professionals to substitute for my sister and me, as neither of us can attend to mom the way we would like to now. They've become surrogate family, and these caregivers are a blessing in disguise. Mom is safe, appropriately dependent, and financially secure. I'm not to worry. But is my mom being honored? Of course I have guilt over too little time spent with her and resentment over too much time spent on tedious things done for her. The latter doesn't feel like honoring, even though I can rationalize it as such. So I've had to reflect a bit more on administration and affection. Last weekend, I conceived of honoring as giving Mom my undivided presence. There were precious moments, although fleeting, where my family and I were caring more about her than for her. It mattered. We returned to the Tri-Cities celebrating the trip and the memories. Our love for our parents changes as we grow older. Honor your father and mother may mean simply being willing to be with them, to get to know them as changing individuals, to let them know us. When I looked across the restaurant table last weekend, I studied Mom's eyes and her hair. I took in her laugh. When she held my hand in church, I thought to myself, I want to remember this. I don't want to get caught up in the bureaucracy of caregiving. Perhaps I've learned something I never could have imagined as a child. Honoring is more of a disposition than an action, more about who I am with Mom than what I do for her. From now on, I'll try to live by this interpretation, a massive reframe of my childhood exposure to an important commandment. From now on, I'll attempt to honor my mother like this, words or no words. Even though it isn't as easy as it sounds, the gift of presence is a kind of honoring. And so it is at different ages, stages of life. It might be a little four-year-old simply obeying Mom and picking up the toys. It may be later stages of life where Mom's mind is going and you're just there holding a hand. Honor your mother. It's the first commandment with promise. Let's pray. Father,